session number 10048, reel number 2.
Mr. Tate, reel 2.
So, there's this period of Stuxt, and I thought I'd go and sit down for a moment. I was so sleepy, I fell asleep. And I'd only slept for moments when I stirred myself and moved out, and the column had moved on. And in the dark, I said, well, I know the direction we're going on, so I followed on, maybe just a matter of hundreds of yards, and there was a forked road. And in the dark, which way now, did I say to myself, did they go? So I took to the left. Luckily, I didn't go very far when I caught up with them again. And this was right in the Belgium border, the Belgian border.
With France?
From France into Belgium. And there was all the Belgian villagers there, gave us a great welcome. But of course, you had to keep on moving.
What? How did they welcome you?
Oh, very, very. Give you food, hot drinks if they had it, anything. And just crowding around you, autograph. But you couldn't linger because things kept moving. You had to move on. Eventually, we came to Antwerp. And it was Boomstraat, which was a big wide boulevard, and the tanks and armoured cars were all lined up side by side by side with the armoured, the troop carriers coming behind. So they moved down Boulevard d'Angleterre, Boulevard the American and the French. It was all one big boulevard, but named under those three countries. And eventually we came to a tunnel, and that was secured, and the docks. But on the way down this boulevard, the Germans could hardly be seen, but they were there. And there was a native of Antwerp, an upstairs window, putting out a flag. Before we arrived, he was just too soon. A German sniper somewhere picked him up. If he just waited a moment until we were abreast his house, he'd been okay.
Did you see him shot?
Yes. And I lost a pal there, Corporal Harris. Gone down this street, there was a curve, and on the left, there was a bakery standing on higher ground. And there was a lot of Germans that had a trench right around this bakery. And from there, my pal, Gordon Harris, got shot right through his belt. And so two tanks had to come down to shelter him, to get the stretcher bearers out to bring him away and clear the street. Eventually, we got up into this area where the Germans were dug in around this bakery. What sticks so clearly in my mind is two German officers talking to each other. One was shot right through here, a bullet. Right through his neck, but it hadn't touched any vital part. He was still able to talk, and he was standing there and shaking hands with his buddy. His buddy was going to be a prisoner. This German officer who was shot, he was being taken away for hospital treatment. So then we were 3 days in Antwerp before the main body of the army arrived to take over the control of the whole city.
What happened in those 3 days?
We consolidated our hold on the docks, but we never got to the other side of the river
Scheldt.
It was weeks and weeks and weeks afterwards before the banks downstream from Antwerp were cleared, before they could get the use of the docks. But our objective was to get the docks and hold them before the Germans could destroy them or blow the tunnel. So where did we go?
What kind of scenes were there in Antwerp in those 3 days?
Oh, the White Brigade were very active. The White Brigade were similar to what the Marquis were in France, resistance fighters. And any shops or stores that had been collaborating with the Germans, I could see them being smashed up and the people in them being dealt with by the White Brigades.
How were they dealt with?
Thumped. I don't know whether any of them would be killed. It's quite possible maybe take someone on the back and shoot them.
But they were being beaten with fists, were they?
Oh, just anything. Kicked, sticks. Some of them had rifles. So then, that was 3 days we were in Antwerp. So that was one of the biggest events, I think. That was a very important objective. And I was proud that I thought I was the one. It, the only time ever I went to a no group to get an objective, next objective.
Did you get as much of a warm welcome in Antwerp as you had in the Belgian villages?
Oh, very, very much so. And the mayor of Antwerp, he said that when the war is over, a monument will be erected to the 11th Armoured Division as being the liberators of this city. I was back in Antwerp about 3 years ago, and I made inquiries, but there was no monument ever put up to the 11th Armoured. But going down this Boomstrasse, there was a man come out of a house on the left-hand side of the road with a cup of tea. And he said, "I've kept this tea from the time the Germans invaded here in 1940 to give to the first British soldiers when they come back. And here you are." So I got a cup of tea. So that was that. Long after the war finished, but I was still in the army, I was in Flensburg on the Danish border. And I was given a truck and a driver and some documents to take back to Antwerp. I was given 8 days to do the trip. But I decided to this driver, we'll drive on day and night when we could do it in 4 days. The return trip, we'll do it in 2 days to Antwerp. And then we'll go to these people I know who gave me this cup of tea. So I went there and told him the situation. I said, "Maybe I have 3 days to spare." Well, he said, "Right, we'll get your truck in out of sight, a 1,500-weight truck." So it was into his backyard and hidden, and we stayed there for 3 days with these people. I never saw them again. It was just this man who gave me such a welcome with this cup of tea, and I went back, and then he kept me for 3 days along with the driver.
Did he tell you anything about what it had been like under the occupation?
Yes. They had a very hard time, and rations were very difficult. He used to fill their bicycle tyres with grass because they couldn't get replacement tyres and something to go on a bicycle and make it softer. Antwerp wasn't badly damaged at that time, but the V1s, the doodlebugs, the V1s were turned on Antwerp, and it was very badly damaged afterwards by these doodlebugs. But I didn't see that damage because I was never back in Antwerp again until I went to visit that man. I went back to Antwerp 4 years ago, just one day, but I couldn't remember much about it because there was so much changed from wartime. I just remember the big long boulevard right through where we approached the city centre. No, where did we go?
Was Antwerp much damaged during the battle for its liberation?
Just in the immediate vicinity of where we went. There wasn't a lot of resistance. Because there was no, just a garrison. They didn't have big guns, there were no field artillery, nor tanks, or anything like that. And I suppose our fast advance had taken them quicker than they could do anything about it. They didn't even have the tunnel blown, which was what they thought it might be before we arrived there, a road tunnel under the River Scheldt.
Did you see much of German prisoners as you went through Europe?
Oh, yes, lots of prisoners. Some that were taking ourselves, others passing down the line all the time, and there are hundreds, long, long columns of them, and they looked so raggedy tag. I suppose once the discipline is gone, they just let themselves go.
In what way?
Well, their dress, because normally they were so smart, but just their coats hanging loose. They couldn't shave, I don't suppose, and sleeping rough at night, because it always took several days before you can get them back to where the proper accommodation and get them onto boats and back to this side.
What did their attitude seem to be? Were they despondent or glad to be captured?
They were despondent, and if they were SS, they were nasty. They spit on you. The SS were wicked. Now, talking about the SS, I had my eye damaged with sand, my left eye. And I had gone to the medical officer, who had his medical officer's truck, was in this field. There was a lot of SS German troops being captured, and they were a black uniform. And they were in this field where the MO had his medical wagon. And I was sitting in this chair, having my eye dressed by an orderly. And because the front was fluid for airmen, it was sometimes difficult to know just exactly where the front was. And he saw all this black uniforms, the German SS, and he struck them. And the medical officer, the orderly, who was on the wagon treating me, was killed. I was left sitting in the chair outside. So that was one of the bad experiences. I'm sitting with my left eye all covered up in whatever medicine he was putting onto it. Now that happened because of this German SS, and happened so quick before they could get a flare to identify who the units were. A yellow smoke flare. But anyway, I was okay. I was up to that. And it didn't bother me. It bothered me a bit now, but only the last few years. Whether it is a result of that or not, I don't know. It maybe just old age bothers me a wee bit now.
So what happened to you after Antwerp?
Well, we came to Holland. Antwerp was the 4th of September. The Guard Armored Division, who were our rivals, they took Brussels the day before, on the 3rd of September. The 11th Armored, they were given the objective, the tunnel, of Antwerp. Then we moved on into Holland. Where are we going, Holland now? On the advance somewhere into Holland. It was night time. And when dawn came this particular morning, I found that the rest of the unit had moved on in the darkness. And there was I, left there with three troop carriers and my own section of 12 with three Lance Corporals. I said, well, where had they all gone? Which way are we going to go now? There was a steeple maybe 3 or 4 miles away sticking up on the flat country. You could see just steeples. I said, right, we'll make for that steeple. So we're driving across this flat country. We came to the edge of this little village. There was a railway line, which I now know was the Antwerp-Dortmund railway line, but I didn't know that then. And here was Germans running across the railway line, further up a bit. Well, this is funny. Went into the village. There was no British troops there, just Germans. Very few of them. So they weren't easy. They weren't difficult to overcome. So we had 20 of them. And the school teacher came out of his school, which was just immediately over this railway line, to welcome us. And she came to me, because I was the only NCO there, corporal. And she gave me a little brooch. And she took it off her dress and pinned it on to me. So then we moved on a little bit and picking up a few Germans here and there, we came to a windmill. and Field's big windmill. And Beltman was the name of the people who had this windmill. But we had all these prisoners, so we herded them all together on the other side of the road, on an open space, and we began to, nightfall came down, and we were the first British troops. So these people always said that I was their liberator, the first of the Allied armies they'd seen. So when night time came down, the Germans opened up with artillery and mortars on this little village of Zeilberg, and was very badly damaged. A lot of the villagers came into this windmill for shelter because it had huge thick walls, and we had these German prisoners outside. I said, well, we just have to keep them there, and I left instructions that no one, not one of those Germans were to talk, because if they were to talk I wouldn't know if they were planning anything. I thought if we keep them still they can't plan anything. I don't allow them to talk. And I changed a guard on them every hour. And one of them had been badly wounded. He had a big hole in his back. And we took him inside the windmill. And there was a Dutch nurse amongst the people. And someone else had a torch, but didn't have a battery. He kept squeezing to a little generator. And they patched up this German's back the best way we could. And this torch going. There was the only light there was in the pitch dark. And this torch went squeak, squeak, squeak. So then morning came, and a chap, Tom Cracknell, and he volunteered to come with me, take these prisoners back. So as soon as we cleared the village of Zeilberg, crossed the railway line onto the open country, the Germans started firing at us. Anyway, we got back, and we discovered an HQ of some kind, and we told them where we come from, and we want to get rid of these 20 people. They said, where have you come from? I said, well, it's Zeilberg. So they just put a flag on the map, Zeilberg. They said, well, just get back to where you've come from. So I saw the chap and I went back to Zeilberg. There was no sign of anybody about. So we had to move on. So we moved on about 2 miles, and we came to the town of Doorn. Doorny.
D-O-O-R-N.
No, D-E-U-R-N-E, Doorn. D-E-U-R-N-E, it's in South Holland, not far from Eindhoven. So I discovered some of our units there, and I told them where we'd been and what had happened. But during this night in this village of Zeilberg, I took a turn and I went outside with these Germans. And in the night time, there was a patrol went down the other side of the road, single file, and I just held my breath. Not a murmur. To this day, I don't know yet, was that a German patrol or a British patrol? They didn't see me, and all these Germans behind the wall. So wasn't that strange? I never reported this to anyone about seeing this patrol officially, because I wasn't going to challenge them. Just let them go. Now, while we were in Doorn, in Zeilberg, there was a teenage girl come down with a plate of bread, some food and sandwiches, to where I was, at the side of the road, and she gave that to me. And that was that. We moved on. 40 years later, and that was a few years ago, I was back in this village, and I came in this girl who came down with this plate of bread.
How did you find her?
I knew her name, and she had corresponded, or her parents did. They were alive then. Her parents did corresponded, but I'm not a writer. Fancy could do the writing with them. So of course she's grown up now and has a family of her own. So we went back to Holland, and they live in Doorn now, about 2 miles from this windmill. So I went back. The big windmill where we sheltered in all night, it's still there. It's a pet food store now. And I told the story about this torch, and squeak, squeak, squeak. Yes, and she went away and came back and said, that's a torch. So after 40 years, they still got this squeaky torch. They'd kept it as a memento. So then, Holland.
How did the British troops behave towards the Dutch and Belgian civilians?
Well, I should think, okay. But I was told by the Dutch that the British soldiers weren't disciplined like the Germans. They were more bothered. I don't know in what way, but the German army was very strict and very well disciplined. They wouldn't get trouble with the soldiers as to the same extent as they did it with the British, I don't think. That was what I was told.
Did you come across any instances of misbehaviour towards civilians?
No. This man at the windmill, the miller, Beltman, was his name. The Germans stole his horses the morning we arrived there first, took away his horses. I don't know if he ever got them back again. I doubt it. But the winter in Holland, we spent a whole winter there then until about March of 1945. And we were allocated a stretch of the River Maas that when winter came on, the Germans retreated right back to the east side of the River Maas, which was a good defensive position to hold all winter. And we were allocated a section of the river, and that was our side. We had to go out at 5 o'clock in the morning and do a 24-hour patrol until 5 o'clock the next morning. So every third day you got this 24-hour patrol on the river. And it was very cold, frost, and fog, freezing fog coming up off the river. And after 24 hours out in the river, the cold, and your eyelids would be hanging down, your eyeballs nearly just sticking out with the cold. And we got back to a place called Baxham. It's about 3 miles back from the bank of the river, big building, where we were building all winter. And while we were there, it was getting shelled too periodically. I got a biff across here with a piece of wood.
Across your upper lip? Across your upper lip?
Yes. And I had the teeth damaged. So I was carted back to a place called Weert, to the school, which was a field dressing station. Another chap in the ambulance with me, he lost a foot. I lost two or three teeth. He was evacuated right back because he was finished with the army then. And I was kept in the field dressing station because I was able to go back to rejoin the unit again in about 10 days' time or so. So then in March, the advance started again. We went up to Nijmegen to where the paratroopers had captured a bridge at Nijmegen. And the Guards Armored Division, they were given the task to go straight from Nijmegen to Arnhem. And we, the 11th Armored, were to go down to the south as right flank protection for Arnhem. There's only the one road from Nijmegen to Arnhem over soft, boggy ground. The armors couldn't deploy, stick to this one road, and they couldn't get through to liberate the paratroopers who had landed at Arnhem. So that was the end of Arnhem because they didn't get through to them. From the position that we were in, I was able to see all the Arnhem landings, saw all the paratroopers coming down, saw the gliders, the towed gliders behind the Dakotas with a troop, that is about 30 men in each glider. Some of them landing okay, others were coming down in flames where they'd been shot, set on fire.
Was it an impressive sight? Was it an impressive sight?
Oh, yes. Oh, it was terrible, though, to see all the part of us. We might have been, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles away, because you could see them clearly. So then, after Arnhem, well, it was the advance on then to the Rhine. I missed the crossing of the Rhine because I was home on leave. That was in April 1945. But when I went back, just immediately after the crossing of the Rhine, first German town went through was Uden. There was none of it standing. It was absolutely flat.
How do you spell it?
U-D-E-M. That was Uden. So then we went right onwards. Can't think of any more very serious incidents happening. We landed in Hamburg, but we didn't have to take that, but we had to pass through and then on to Lübeck on the Baltic, which we approached very fast, so fast that when we arrived in the town of Lübeck, the trams were running. Life was normal. The German forces off duty, wandering on the streets, just enjoying themselves. But the prisoners came in very, very easily because the Russians were approaching from the east. And to this day, the Russian line is still just 3 miles east from Lübeck. So that's where I got a chance to drive tram cars. The streets had to be cleared, so I had to get all these trams into them and get them off the street. Our next objective after Lübeck was to have been Kiel, but we only moved a few miles from Lübeck up the road when everything was halted. That was the 6th of May. The war was to finish on the 8th. So why this couldn't have finished on the 6th, I don't know. But anyway, that was the end of the war. So then afterwards, we had to go up to Flensburg, which is a German town. It's on the Danish frontier. And when we got there, a barrier was thrown right around the town. And every male in that city was taken into big compounds and interrogated and then released. There was a big castle, Glücksberg Castle, where what remained of the German government was there. Admiral Dönitz, who died just a year or two ago, he was deputy Führer after Hitler died in Berlin. So the brigade, the 159 brigade that the Third Mons were in, we were sent to this castle. To a few days, the war must have been over a couple of weeks or so before we were told to go and bring in this German government, because they were still organising things, but under British command. So there was Dönitz and several others who were taken in. Of course, that was officers who had to do that.
What was this castle?